This is Find a Way, a podcast that gives me an excuse to record important conversations with my community of friends, family, and neighbors. We may not be intergalactically famous, but we're no less inspiring or impactful on the world. Plus, I have my own selfish reasons. I know that one day when I'm old and tired of TV and the news, and hopefully wise enough to avoid scrolling myself into oblivion, I will dig up these treasured recordings, some of which I'll never share on the podcast, and I will delight myself with the beauty that I find. So, like a squirrel hoarding away nourishment for winter, I seek to chronicle the wisdom and kindness of my community so that one day I might find a way back, even if I don't feel lost. I'm Colin Whitlock of the Show and Tell Neighborhood, and this is Find a Way.
So am I supposed to, when I...
Yeah, there you go.
Speak directly?
You can, yeah, as long as it's like facing
Hello.
The general direction, you're good.
Okay.
Your levels are great, I think. And I'm just going to put this over here.
Wow, my levels.
Your levels. It's real now. It's really happening. That's good.
We All right, and now out. We're done. Ah! Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So
find a way. That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
Ah! Yes. Well, there's other stuff, but there's also that.
There's also just the...
there's also that. Yeah.
It's good to get that out, though. God.
Okay. So anything we need to know before we like really dive in?
Right. So the main thing is,
do we have like a goal?
Just this, really.
Okay.
Like the reason why I wanted to start doing this is I foresee a time in my life, I mean, even right now, but I foresee a time in the future in my older days where it's going to really, having these conversations just in raw form is going to be very valuable to me and maybe to, you know, my family and my friends and things like that. I think they're important. And so I've had this thought like, oh, I should, you know, ask people to come and sit and talk with me. But then I thought like, is that weird just to ask somebody to come over and sit and record a conversation?
I mean, not if they like you and they like talking to you.
Right. And that's the goal.
As everyone should.
Everyone. And so I thought like, well, if I do a podcast, then...
Well, okay. So it would help me though to have just sort of a general framework. Like, are you going to ask me questions? Do we... Like, I know your podcast has a theme.
Right. The theme is sort of, yeah. So my basic theme is I find myself surrounded by really incredible people. Like our community is, and our wider community too, people I don't know as well. We still seem to have this high concentration of just passionate, loving people.
100%.
And I'm curious about like, how do you do it? Like, how are you happy? You know, how are you like, what drives you to connect the way you do and to put all the effort that you put into your family, your friends, your loved ones? Like, that's the very basic.
That's a beautiful question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So answer it.
Oh.
Our guest this week is Haley Hillman. An open book, an impassioned advocate for the divine light inside us all, a natural-born nurturer, a birth doula and photographer with a love for the outdoors and therapeutic horticulture. To her children, River and Ike, Haley is a stout-hearted protector and loving mom. To her husband, Chris, whom she married 2 months after this conversation, she is a beacon of light and a long-awaited soulmate. To me and our community, Haley is a supportive friend who has no desire for small talk if there's a chance to dig deep into what's really important. And that alone makes me feel safer in my own skin. It is my pleasure to share a beautiful conversation we had together back in March of 2025. This will be Find a Way's final episode of season one, and I can't think of a better way to end this first leg of our journey together. More on that later. In the meantime, thank you for finding your way here today. Enjoy.
I can't. Okay, I can't.
I'm sorry. So that is not actually my question for you.
Tell me how to be happy.
Yeah, help me.
Drugs, hey, right. Therapy.
Whatever works. Yeah, I'm curious. But really, what I'm looking to capture, though, is that kind of, like, if you and I were sitting down to lunch or just a cup of coffee like we're doing right now, what we would talk about, I think, is significant. Even if it seems small, even if it seems, you know, ordinary, I don't think it is. I think it's more valuable than a curated interview where I come up with questions and I'm going to dig deep into your character. And
you can dig, Colin.
I would love. I'm going to dig. Listen,
let's go.
We've got time. We've got our lives ahead of us. We're going to dig.
We have our whole lives together.
That's right.
Here in this room.
In this room.
Well, I'm really an open book. There's basically no TMI with me. I think there's nothing you could ask me that I wouldn't tell you, probably.
I cannot tell you how much I love that about you.
Thanks, Colin.
That is something that is so refreshing. And I understand why other people have boundaries and don't feel safe doing those things.
Totally.
And I support it. And I would never, you know, diminish that in them, or at least diminish that quality in a person. But sitting down with somebody who has that sort of willingness to be open and vulnerable is like a cool breeze on a sunny beach, you know,
it's just the best. Love to hear that. Well, I think that part of it has to do with my neurodivergence, because I don't feel like small talk is particularly worthwhile. So like, if we're going to talk, let's like tell me all your like hopes, dreams, fears. Yes. Like, let's get to the heart of it.
God, I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly my spot, too.
Yeah,
and
right?
I believe we both land very close to each other on that spectrum. And I love that I want that from people and that I want to give it to people.
Yeah.
Sometimes people don't love that I want to give it to them.
Like they can't receive it?
Right. Yeah. I've had many experiences in my life where I have that moment of realization that I'm oversharing, or at least from the other person's perspective, I am oversharing, and maybe it makes them feel uncomfortable, including family members, you know?
Yes. I feel like that comes up with family probably more than with friends, because you choose the friends.
There you go.
And you are
right
assigned to the family.
Yeah. And I think that maybe there's a there's an extra, I mean, it should it exists with friends too, but there seems to be an extra element with family where the other family members almost feel as though they have ownership or a perceived association with these things that you're sharing. And so it's almost like if you share it, you're exposing them too, you know?
Yes. Or also, you know, that they have a certain idea about you and about the things that you should be feeling and expressing.
Mm.
And then you say something real from the heart and it's like, no, that's right. Not aligned with what I think you should be. So.
That is like such a struggle too. And maybe that's why, you know, our ability to choose friends sometimes feels safer, because, you know, we naturally gravitate toward people who accept those aspects of us. But it is an odd challenge that so many families seem to fail to face, which is the allowance of your family members to change and to surprise you.
Yes. And I have a really good family. I'm close with my family.
Yeah.
My family is amazing. Yeah. It's so good. But yeah, I mean, I think that probably exists with any relationship that's super, super long.
Yes.
Also, like, your parents made you. Like, yeah. I mean, I feel this a little bit with my kids, although they're not big enough, I think, for me to feel inflexible about it. But it's like, you know, literally I made you. And so you do feel a sense of ownership in that way. Although they come out, my experience has been for sure that they come out already like a person with like a whole host of traits, wants, needs.
Where do you think that comes from? Do you ever wonder about that?
Well, I think most of it's genetics.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, you know, we could get into a whole discussion of, you know, the soul, et cetera. But
I don't know if we've ever really like dug in with spiritual beliefs or anything together. Do you have any?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you all about it.
I mean, you
also, gave me... I want to flip it back and ask you too, Colin. But
yeah. Don't worry. Okay. You wish you hadn't, but
no. Oh wait. Oh yeah. I forget. You're like you're woo woo about all this stuff.
Yeah. So I'm like, so woo.
Yeah. Chris has not told me like in great depth, but he's like, oh yeah, Colin like really like likes the occult and like, you know,
oh,
like,
well,
yeah.
It's I'm very curious about that.
Yes.
Yeah. Whether a belief goes into it, I mean, I'm sure it does, but unintentionally sometimes.
Do you find yourself getting like fringier in your older age?
No, but I do find I find that the stuff that elicits the most judgment, like that would like put the label of fringe on it, what I find is the fringe or cringe that goes with it usually is strongest in the beginning. And the more I learn and the more I like allow those concepts to marinate, the more I should say the less extreme they seem. I think the reason why they have this cringy feeling in the beginning is because they sound so radical. They sound disconnected from a lot of common logic. But I do begin to see correlations that normalize it a little bit more. So, so for example, like there's one of the most basic concepts in the occult, and the occult is a very broad term.
Yes.
It could mean so many things, but in general, there's one phrase that kind of permeates through a lot of different belief systems, which is as above, so below. Right. And this that concept is basically saying that, like, and the phrase mirrors itself, as above, so below, so below, as above. Right. And so that basic idea is that the actions that we make on our plane of existence are reflected in the higher plane. And therefore, the higher plane of existence is also reflected in the lower plane, right? Oh. And so, like, you see that concept in so many different belief systems. Like in Christianity, the idea that, you know, God created man in the image of himself, right? Or herself or itself. That concept is as above, so below, right? Like this idea that, you know, things are, we represent the heavens and the heavens represent us. So that could be easily like, ooh, I don't know about that. That's pretty wild. But then when you start looking into like fractal theory in math and these like these systems that we know exist for sure that are reflective and exact versions of themselves on each different scale, you're like, oh, as above, so below. That's what it means. It's like a scientific term that actually makes sense, right?
Wow, that's really beautiful. And I like that you could kind of connect it back to math and then it connects back to the natural world and right. All of that too. I think where people get kind of tripped up, and this is true for me, is like, it's not just the ideas, but the ideas are attached to groups of people. And sometimes those groups of people are really problematic.
Yes.
And are hurting other people. And I think you're right that if you kind of distill it down to just the beliefs, mm-hmm. you can wrap your mind around it. You can get it. But the problem is that the way that it's used and applied gets really dicey.
Especially when the people you're talking about begin exerting their will upon others, like this
yes.
is what that means.
Yes.
And if you don't think so, then you're wrong or whatever.
Yes. Well, okay. So I'll give you some background on kind of my religion thing. Okay. So my mom's side of the family, super conservative, religious, Southern Baptist.
Okay.
She grew up that way. And then actually, like very impressively to me in college, like saw the light, so to speak, and left religion and or left that religion, like mm-hmm. changed her voter registration, became a Democrat, like just totally yeah. changed, became a vegan eventually, like went way on the other side. And so we were raised going to church, like a Methodist church, which it didn't really resonate with me, but she continued to require that I do that all the way through college. I'd have
wow.
to go to church when I came home.
Okay.
Like, really?
Oh, when you came home to visit.
When okay. I came home.
I thought you meant like home from school, you went to church. And I was like, okay, that's next level.
She locked me in a room. No. Yes, I was out of state for college. But when I came back, I'd have to go. And so, I think that it didn't ever really connect with me. But then when I went to college, I went to a school called Guilford in North Carolina, and it's Quaker. And that was when I was introduced to Quakerism.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, like this feels good. This feels right. Basically, Quakerism is technically a Christian religion, but it's really flexible and expansive. So you can have any kind of religious beliefs. You could really be an atheist Quaker. You could be a Buddhist Quaker. You could really be anything.
Yes.
But it's sort of more of a religious philosophy,
mm-hmm.
although there's different like kind of churches and different, like there's some like very Christian Quakers, but for the most part, it's very open-ended. And so kind of the underlying belief of Quakerism is that like each person carries the light of the divine or the light of God, whatever you want to call it, within, like some mm-hmm. sort of divine light. And so because each person carries, you know, the light of the divine within, it causes all these other beliefs to fall into place. So things like equality, like Quakers have always been really big yes. on, you know, gender equality, racial equality, like all of the kinds of equality. Simplicity is a big part of it. Like, you know, not doing a bunch of other stuff that's like distracting from like, you know, our divine essence, I guess you could say.
Mm.
And then social justice. Quakers like always have been on the right side of history and to the present, like have like lobbying social justice organizations, like, you know, always trying to like promote honestly what to me feels like the greater good.
Yes.
And then the Quakers that I met at Guilford were just like the coolest, the most down to earth, like also like fun, happy, just like grounded, beautiful people. Mm. And I was like, whatever you're drinking, like I want some of that.
Yeah.
And the way that Quaker churches, they call it meeting for worship. Basically, you just sit in a room in silence. And this is called unprogrammed meeting. They also have some that are like more churchy, but the ones that I like are unprogrammed. And yeah, basically you just all sit together and you sort of like settle into the silence. And then if anyone feels led to speak, you just stand and share a message. And, you know, it can just sort of be like whatever comes upon you. They say that basically, like if you can't not speak, like that's the time to speak. Like when it's like kind of like bursting from your lips, like something to share. And so people will stand and share, or like sometimes sing, or like, you know, whatever comes to mind. And then they sit back down and everyone kind of like lets it settle in. And then oftentimes like other messages will come that are kind of connected or sometimes not, but like, you know, kind of anything can come up. But I find it almost always to be like really thought provoking, really interesting, like really moving. And, you know, sometimes you'll have no messages and you'll just sit in silence for an hour.
Beautiful.
Sometimes you'll have a lot. It just totally depends. And it's lovely. It's really lovely. Mm. And so like it's something that you can connect to kind of no matter who you are and what you believe, if you can, you know, handle sitting in silence for an hour, which can be really challenging. Like if you've never done it before, you're kind of there with your own thoughts. But anyone who like resonates with like you know, like that kind of contemplation, contemplative tradition. There we go.
Oh yeah,
contemplative.
Nobody will tell me.
Hello.
I think
if you know, could you let us know, please?
Please. If somebody feels moved to tell us.
We're wondering. Well, whichever one it is, that thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So if like, so if that feels good to you, it's just, it's lovely. And there is a Quaker meeting here in Gainesville, and they also have like a little outdoor space too with like benches. So you sit in a circle mm-hmm. usually, and it's just really lovely. So yeah. So when I found Quakerism, it really felt right to me. And it's not very like dogmatic. You can choose like if you want to connect it to Christianity in some way or if you don't. And it's just been really great. It's also nice to feel kind of grounded in like a set of moral principles.
Yes.
But that's not connected to any of the ick. Like, as far as I know, the Quakers aren't oppressing anyone.
Yeah.
You know, everybody is welcome. You just show up as yourself. And I just... when you think of each person as like precious in that way, as having this light within, it's like every person then is inherently valuable, and it helps you keep that in mind about what's really important. Mm. You know, everyone has a story to tell. Everyone is valuable. No person is more valuable than any other person. I mean, that's all there is, basically.
Yes, that is so lovely. I really connect with that. And actually, you're reminding me. I had a roommate for a couple of years who was and is a Quaker, and I'm sure he attended the same meetings that you're talking about. And I remember having, you know, falling in love with the concept way back, you know, I don't know how long ago that was, almost 15 years ago, thinking like, what a, you know, simple yet mind-blowing concept, you know, this. And I don't think I realized what an impression it made on me, because as you're saying it back to me, I'm thinking like, yeah, that's what I think. That's this podcast. I think every single person who wants to come and sit and talk with me has something very important to share. Whereas I can remember when I first told some people I was starting a podcast, they were like, who wants to listen to us? You know, like, who are you going to have, like, you know, Gainesville celebrities come in? Are you going to have, you know, and I'm so tired of this idea that somebody has to be famous in order to have something worthy of being listened to.
100%. I totally agree.
And if anything, if I had to choose one side of that argument, I would maybe choose the opposite. You know, like, not to say that I disagree with everything they say, but I disagree with a lot. But yeah, even the setup of a community gathering together and sitting and waiting for this inspiration to speak, that's my whole approach with show and tell, you know, at the Bull. That's why I tell everybody at night, when we get together, I'll say, listen, I have a theme. Here's the theme. But don't let the theme stop you. Like, if you feel like you need to say something, if it comes up for you, don't question it. Just come up and say it. And I bet you it relates to the theme. But if it doesn't, who cares? Like, that's the point.
I love that.
Yeah.
It is really the same idea.
Yeah.
It's like channeling
Divine.
Yeah, something else. Or you could even say channeling like your own inner voice, or, yes, you know.
Which I think that is the divine. Like,
yeah.
And I think, you know, to maybe piggyback off of what you just shared and like go deeper into how I relate with it, I feel like this inner light that you're discussing here, that you're talking about, I find it for myself, I find my top priority in life is trying to reach it, you know, to try to access this, whatever you, I the word pure kind of doesn't sound right, but whatever this beautiful, like, light, this divine light is within me. I feel like our society creates these, like, walls between us and that.
Yes.
That I use the word pure just in that it's not diluted. You know, and these filters change the light, you know, they go over the light and it shifts the light a little bit, and it's maybe not as bright, or it doesn't shine as clear. And I feel like those filters are sort of like our shame and our fears and
yes.
our, and so I'm constantly, my inner work and my spiritual practice is basically like, how do I peel back these layers so that I can get a glimpse, you know, so I can let this light shine through, even if just for a moment, you know?
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So do you have specific practices around that? Like, do you sit in meditation, or like, what does that look like?
Yes. I meditate every morning and every night for like 20 minutes each time.
That's a lot. That's amazing.
It seemed like a lot when we first started. Audrey and her mom started before me. They did transcendental meditation. And I remember saying to them, like, you want me to take 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes at night just like to do that? I am too busy. I got too much to do, you know, that kind of thing. And I finally, you know, they did it for about a year, and I recognized, like, it's helping. It's really, you know. And so, yeah, I got into it, and part of it, not all of it, but part of it is reaching a sort of, blank state. I mean, that's what it's, transcendence is, this like non-thought, you know, just, and when I'm able to separate from my thoughts, all of a sudden it's this incredible peace and sort of like buzzing. And I think like, oh, this is me, you know?
Wow.
The other stuff is like glommed onto me, but this is like floating. This is, you know, really nice. And so that really helps, you know, that helps kind of create a, what's the term for when you've got a point that you can always go back to,
I don't know.
You know what I think about? It's the reason why squirrels will like run all the way across the street and then a car comes and they'll turn around and run all the way back across the street, because they've got like a tree that they've honed in on, and that's like their turning back point.
It's your tree.
It's my tree.
It's your tree.
It's my tree that might kill me.
Squirrel tree. Yeah.
It's the tree that might make me get run over by a car, but
I'll
go back to it.
But you will go back to it.
I will return to it.
Unless you get hit by a car.
So I guess it's like a reference point or something for this, like, you know, part of me that feels really clear. And then that helps associate with other practices for me. So, for example, like I realize that playing music is certain times, not all the time, but there are certain times where I let go while playing music.
That's lovely. It's like a flow state that you get into.
Exactly right. That is exactly the term. That's what I should have started with. Yeah.
That's okay. I knew what you meant. That's beautiful. And, you know, back to the meditation, like the science backs up exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even matter how many minutes you meditate for. I think the longer you go, the more benefit. But even like 5 minutes a day, they say it's basically, and it doesn't matter how many times you have to like return back to the breath. It's just the act of like you're sitting in silence, you get distracted by your own thoughts, and then you kind of let them go and like return back to yourself. That is the act that is changing the brain.
Yes.
Which is amazing. So you don't even have to be good at it. It actually doesn't even matter. Like you can, however many times you have to get like, have to redirect, it doesn't matter. You're still getting the benefit. How great is that?
It's beautiful.
Don't have to be good.
Yeah. And that's a huge, I mean, that was something that I really had to allow people to remind me about when I started this. Because,
like, God, I suck at this.
Yeah. God, I went back to my, I had thoughts interrupt me 10 times, you know, or 50 times or whatever.
You're like, great. And that's totally fine.
That's great. Well done.
Just as good as if it's zero times, which, like, wow, that's nice.
Well, and you know, the other thing that really struck me as significant when I started was I'd sit and I'd close my eyes and I'd try to clear my thoughts, and then, you know, something would pop up, and it's something stressful, you know, whether it's good stress or bad stress, it's something popping up. And I would think, oh God, yeah, I gotta prepare for that, or I gotta set up for this, or I gotta. And what I started to realize is as you acknowledge the thought and then let it go, I am saying to myself and whatever else there is out there, like, nothing is my priority right now other than finding this transcendence. Like,
just be here right now. That's
unless
all.
There is a fire in this house and I have to get out of here. And actually, when we first started, Audrey and I were really good about, you know, the afternoon meditation is the hardest one. And we would have dinner plans with somebody at 6:30 and it would be 6:15 and we're supposed to meditate for 20 minutes. We would say, like, we're going to be late, you know, and we would meditate.
I love that. You know, do you sit together?
A lot of times. Yeah. Almost always in the morning. Yeah.
That's so nice.
Yeah. It's such a great.
It's a great ritual.
I really love it. I don't know. You know, the morning ones are so easy to do because it's so pleasant. And the afternoon ones challenge you to stop what you're doing and sit. And I've never regretted doing a meditation. Not once in my life.
So, yeah. I feel like it's like that with exercise a lot of the time, too. It's like so hard to get to, but then when you get to it, you never regret doing it.
That's another flow state for me.
Yes. So you were telling me the things that connect to your practice. So like the meditation being the foundation and then connecting to like these other things that are part of your practice. So you said music being one.
Definitely.
Yes.
This.
Yeah. Like
talking.
Basic human connection.
But the kind, what you started us off talking about is this, I mean, I can glad hand with people and I understand why maybe I shouldn't say glad hand. I can small talk with people. Sure. Glad handing, I think, is a little bit like...
Schmoozy.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. Which I can do, too. I just, you know, I was trained to do it, so...
trained.
Know, I get it.
Schmoozer. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, you know. But I don't... I think one of the reasons why I have such an affinity for this kind of communication, this kind of connection, is because I do sense the inauthenticity of the schmoozing conversations, mm-hmm. the small talk. And those do not... Small talk is, I think, the definition of covering up. You know, I am putting a filter in front of myself for your benefit or for their, you know, they're doing it for my benefit. And I just, life's too short.
I feel like that too. But I don't think everyone agrees.
No.
I think for a lot of people, it's maybe more comfortable.
Certainly.
Being in that space.
I think covering up ourselves sometimes is more comfortable, is safer.
Yeah. I just don't know what to do in those situations. Like, I'm out in like a group setting and I'm just like, hey, and I'm like, what do I say now? That's all I got. On the inside, on the outside, I'm just like, okay, where's Chris? Why?
Totally. Yeah. I know. And I think sometimes... That's where my humor comes out a lot of times. Mm. When I get that moment, I think, well, let's goof then. If we're gonna be inauthentic, instead of small talk, let's goof talk. Let's laugh a little, because I do not think of this ahead of time. I think this is instinctual, but upon reflection, I find that if we can laugh or just like get silly, it almost opens up the door saying like, oh, we're being silly, I can let down my guard a little bit, as opposed to, how about that weather? Whew. Yeah, you think it's gonna be hot again tomorrow? I bet it will. Yeah,
I have trouble getting to that silly,
I know,
place too.
Certainly.
Like, a lot.
Yeah,
as you know, I don't like jokes.
Right.
And I don't like voices.
And yet we love each other.
Well, I like, you know, yeah, it's really kind of hard to explain. And this is like another, neurodivergence thing.
Certainly.
But Chris just always says, like, it's so funny because you really have a great sense of humor. And yes. It's just like, there's this thing that I don't like. And it's a little bit hard for me to describe, but it's just like, it's like this... acting silly. I don't know. It's like too... I don't know what the too much is, but it's something about it is like, mm-hmm. gives me the ick, and I just can't even.
Are there versions of goofiness that do feel safe for you? You know, like, for example, I think there are... my favorite kind of goofiness is childishness. You know, being just... there's no better word for that. Just childishness. As opposed to... sarcasm or things like that.
Sarcasm to me is fine.
Yeah.
I think that, like, even like playing pretend, mm-hmm. with my kids, I hate that.
Yeah.
Okay. I do not like that at all. It's the same thing.
Does it feel like lying?
No.
Okay.
No. And I'm not opposed to like someone like them doing it or like, sure. I think it's just... It's just out of my comfort zone. Like, it's just too, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's really hard to explain.
You know, though, there's something about it, because I think it would be, when we first met, for real, and started getting to know each other, and you told me about this.
Yes.
I remember thinking to myself, like, this could be a problem. Like, what am I going to do? This is a big part of who I am. Just like goofing around, doing voices, that kind of
thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it occurred to me, it didn't bother me. It didn't, I mean, it made me sort of like give second thought to some of my instincts, right? which, you know, can be good or bad. I think it's good, right? I think the people in my life who make me reevaluate certain aspects of myself that I've become very used to and even comfortable with, that always, again, it's like exercise. I never regret that reflection. And so I think that maybe was the catalyst for me coming around on this thought of like, it's kind of beautiful that you just, that this exists for you, that this
thanks.
Well, because I think there's a lot of pressure to go along with that, especially in our society. I think a lot of people use humor to cover up the existential dread that we're all like 100% avoiding.
Yes.
And so to not go there because it doesn't feel right is that devotion to that self, you know, that light that you've got. And it's like, you're not going to just stuff that down so I can like, that English accent is so accurate, you know?
It's like, I got to go.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I do think maybe it is like part of, I am a very concrete thinker. I like, and again, like definitely part of neurodivergence, but like, Chris will, he likes to, he says, like, push the boundaries of this, like, of this thing that I have. And so he'll make a joke or say something to me. And, like, a lot of the time, like, I won't get it at all because, like, I'm just, like, a really concrete, he's like, I'm like, are you kidding? He'd be like, obviously, like, obviously I'm kidding. But I just, like, yeah, I just can't quite get it. And I think that maybe that is connected to like the not liking, it's like voices, improv, like just like the same, it's like too wishy-washy for me.
Okay.
Like I just need things to be more black and white.
Sure. I don't blame you. That's the way I feel about, I think that's the same place, or that's the same thing that got me to the place of wanting honest communication. Mm. Because I grew up in the town that I grew up in, there was a lot of bullshit. There was a lot of, you know, smiling behind or putting a smile in front of judgment, putting, you know, pleasantries. There, when I got to Gainesville and met my first, you know, real close group of friends in my freshman dorm. I remember having this realization I can remember it. We were in Yulee Pit and it was a beautiful day in October. It was cold in October. And I remember thinking, I love this place so much because it's cold in October. And then it wasn't cold again for 15 years.
but you got that one day.
It made me fall in love with the place. And I remember thinking, like, these are what, like, friends are. Mm, these are what,
that's
like,
so beautiful.
Beautiful, kind people are. And we weren't perfect. We weren't, you know, it wasn't. And it's not to say that I didn't have really close friends in my hometown either. I did. But the overall atmosphere was so oppressive with bullshit and with, you know, ego and things like that, that now, when I encounter people who are passive aggressive, who, you know, are judgmental about people like behind their backs, but then like are so nice to them and everything like that, I want, just like you say, like when you hear a voice, you just want to get out of the room. Somebody doing an impression or something. When I see that, I'm like, I want out of this. I got to get out of here. I don't want this.
It's just an automatic no for you. And that really like speaks really highly of you, Colin, that like that's your instinct. It's kind of mine too. It's like, why? Just why? Why? Yeah. Why do you want to spend your time like bringing other people down? I'm thinking still like about what you said about like your practice of like peeling back the layers from your light. And I just think that's so beautiful.
Thanks.
It's really, you know, I think for me, becoming a parent, and I think a lot of people have this experience in sort of like losing yourself in parenthood. I feel like, you know, I've been a parent now for like the last 6.5 years. And I feel like the layers get thicker and thicker and thicker and more and more and more to where you don't even like, I find myself not even thinking about my own light anymore.
Yes.
And I think it's getting easier for me. But
it's definitely an experience that, you know, I think both, you know, parents of both genders, but definitely for mothers in particular, you know, who go through the whole, all the sacrifice that we go through.
So much.
Yeah.
I mean, you really, it is a full circle sacrifice. You know, your internal body, your external body, your community, your family structure, like everything changes.
It's everything. And so, yeah. And, you know, in my work as a doula, I'm constantly kind of walking families through this passage. And it's such an honor to get to walk alongside people in these like really vulnerable times. But yeah, I think something I say a lot is that like postpartum is forever. Like we, in our society, you know, we don't have really any benefits for new families. And so a lot of people have to go back to work at like 6 or 8 weeks postpartum, which is like ridiculous. Like you're still like bleeding and not sleeping and, you know, sustaining for many people, sustaining a human with your body still. But, you know, even like beyond the early postpartum days, like you're never the same after becoming a parent.
Right.
Like you're never the same ever again. And I think that's something like I didn't really realize before becoming a parent. I think everything I thought about being a parent was wrong.
Yeah.
Like I had all these ideas. A friend of mine who just became a mom, we were laughing the other day because it's like, she'd be like, I thought I'd have a baby and I'd be like sitting drinking coffee, like just like having a good old time, like with my baby. And it's like, I totally thought that too.
Yeah.
And I remember like after I had my first baby, who was like the most colicky, like sad, difficult baby. And I like would go out places and see people with their babies, like out at a restaurant, just like having brunch, having a good old time. And I was like so bitter because it would never, and there was no universe in which that could have happened with either of my babies. And I like, it occurred to me then, it's like, I thought this is what you did because like, well, the babies that are out at brunch are like the babies that can be out at brunch.
Right.
We don't see all the other babies that are at home just fucking screaming all day long. So that's what happened to me.
Exactly. Do you feel, I mean, it seems to me that that is such a, again, going back to our desire for things to just be out in the open and for real, there are so many things that our society sort of subtly hides from us that then are just laying in wait for us to stumble upon when we decide to, I don't know, like have a child.
Yes.
And like, ah, well, every movie, TV show, every restaurant you've been out to, every public place where you've seen child rearing.
It's all a lie.
It's all
a lie. I know. Now I watch movies and every baby just sits there and doesn't cry. And I'm like, this is why I thought my baby was going to basically just be like a stuffed animal and like just do nothing. And I would just cuddle it sometimes. And there are babies that are like that.
Yeah.
And I like when I have clients who like, I'm like, wow, like, you know, this is, you're so lucky because like, and the experience is, it is true that like, that makes for like a really beautiful postpartum experience. If you have a baby that you can lay down, and a friend of mine, we had our second babies around the same time, and I at like maybe like 6 weeks or so, I was just talking about how he was having all these GI issues. Like I had to cut my diet. I was only eating like 10 foods to try to like eliminate foods that were upsetting his stomach, and like he was crying all the time. And she's like, I feel really bad because I basically have just been like drinking mimosas for the last 6 weeks while my baby like lays there and sleeps. I'm just like,
oh my God.
I hate you right now. And honestly, her kids are still really pretty easy. Yeah. And she's like, yeah, like our younger child was like having all these behavior issues. And like, we were like, oh, maybe we need to like figure out something about like parenting now. The kid's like 4. And she's like, but then it just went back to normal and it was fine. And like, meanwhile, like,
wow,
I'm living a very different reality.
Very much.
Which like, I love my kids and I'll always love my kids, but neither is easy. They're very high maintenance. You know, it's been a different journey. And I, at various points, like I, in the thick of it, cause you know, River being autistic and like having from the very beginning, like came out, like really from the moment I went into labor, things just sort of started to go wrong. Like my pregnancy had been totally fine. Everything had been okay. Although looking back, I did have lice and the stomach flu while I was pregnant. So it's like some little foreshadowing.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Of what was to come.
That's so rough.
Right? But yeah, so the birth was really difficult, and it was like just kind of everything just kept going wrong. And then when River was born, they came out with a fever and needed the NICU right away. And I just remember like being just like gutted, because I had had this vision. I was going to do this birth center birth and everything was going to be perfect. And none of that happened. We had to transfer and all this. And then after everything, like finally, like, you know, the baby came out, and then it's like, I hadn't even considered the possibility that we would have to be separated. And that was a trauma that was with me for many years.
Yeah.
It's just, and now, I mean, I feel grateful because I can relate to clients of mine who've had the same experience, because it's just like, a mother is supposed to be with their baby.
Yeah.
And when your baby has to be separated from you, like, it's not okay, and you're right. not okay.
Yes.
It's just like a biological
right.
basic need yes. to be with your baby. And so, and there's, you know, of course, you know, you can comfort and you can be there, but there's nothing that you can do to take that pain away from someone. And so, but then, you know, we had just all these just sort of like challenge after challenge, feeding issues, developmental delays, and then just like crying all the time. Just came out just fucking furious.
Yeah.
And I was like, this isn't what I thought was supposed to happen.
Certainly, yeah.
I was like, I we would try, like at 2 months old, River could only tolerate being held, knew who was holding them, and could only tolerate being held by me and their dad. 2 months old. That is not, like, babies at 2 months old are like blobs.
Yeah.
They don't know anything. This baby knew. And when then just even my parents, who we were living with at the time, just hysterical, screaming. Like, I at one point ventured out, like at a couple months, like just to go to the grocery store for like an hour. I basically didn't go anywhere without them because they were so dependent on me. And, you know, my mom, who's so amazing and like not ruffled by any of this, is just like, yeah, we're okay. But like, cried the whole time.
Wow.
Cried the whole time. And I spent like basically that whole first year, we had this like hammock chair, and I basically spent the years like the only place that River would be calm. I like spent that year basically just like sitting in that hammock chair with this sad, sad baby. And so we kind of, you know, tried to figure it out, and like, you know, various things like diagnosed with hip dysplasia. Like, we were, you know, doing all the therapies and different things. And so and things kind of like around a year, 18 months, sort of like River sort of caught up on milestones. But then around 3, I started to really notice some differences, and first sort of sensory differences, and then just always emotional regulation challenges, like
right.
would go like to level 100 and then just like could not come back down.
Right.
And then I started to notice things with play, like other kids would come up and try to engage in play, but then River would like not understand that it was engaging in play and would just like push or hit or like would freak out. Like, and if they were playing a game with like the dinosaurs, they had to play with all the dinosaurs. Like, they couldn't move one dinosaur, like very rigid,
right.
like stuck in like certain ideas about play. And then just things like, we were at 4th Avenue Food Park, and this like sweet little girl that we knew came up and said like, hi. And then River just took a handful of mulch and just like threw it right in their face. Like, and I was like, oh my God. And it was just like, right. It was just too much.
Right.
Like, and it wasn't like, you know, this is only a 3-year-old, like not mean or like not, but just like for whatever reason, like even that level of social interaction at that time, we had to basically like completely stop play dates or anything. It's just like, couldn't handle it. And so we were in some different therapies, and the therapists were kind of like, have you like had an autism test? I brought it up with the pediatrician, like, no, like it's not autism. And I was like, okay, well, just like refer us anyway. I had to like push hard just to get in for the evaluation. But
sure.
because my mom works for the Department of Psychiatry at UF, through nepotism, I was able to connect with someone really great.
There you go. You got to use
yeah,
it when you got it.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah. I like was able to like kind of handpick who did the evaluation, someone who was really knowledgeable, you know, kind of about like a more atypical, you know,
certainly
versions. And luckily, once we got the evaluation, it was like pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And so River has like level 1 communication diagnosis, which means that's like the most, you know, quote unquote high functioning level, and mm-hmm. level 2 social. And so, but yeah, it's like, kind of continuing to the present day, it started hard, and it's and it's been hard. Not to say that there like hasn't been joy, of course,
yeah.
but like it's been hard. And like, we don't live in a world that's set up for people with disabilities, and we don't live in a world that is set up to support families that like that with where one person has a disability. And it's just been, yeah, it's been a lot. And so there have been moments where like I genuinely ask myself, like, if I could go back and I was going to have this exact same experience, like, you know, yes. these same two kids, the exact same things happen, like, would I do it again? And yeah. I had to sit with that question.
Of course. Yeah.
And I think more parents think about these things than are willing to admit it, because like, let's say my kids one day listen to this, like, love you guys, love you.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want your kids to think you don't love them.
Of course you do.
And of course, like, yeah. I love them. That's not even like a part of the question. But, you know, if I were to say, yeah, I wouldn't do it again, like, what does that say to these beings that I brought into the world?
Certainly.
But, you know, but genuinely, like, my answer is that I would do it again. Like, I've known my whole life that I wanted to be a parent. Like, it wasn't ever a question.
Yeah.
And, you know, would I, if I had a magic wand, would I change things to make them easier? Obviously.
I mean, who
obviously, yeah, yes. Right. But, like, if those were my only two options, like, you know, if these, like, if the universe has truly picked these two souls for me, and this is the version that I get, which, of yes. course, is the reality, I would do it again.
Yeah,
I would do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't think that there's anything wrong with really, I think there would be something wrong with not contemplating that option. You know, if you just were like, oh, absolutely not, you know, not, no thought about it, you know, just, but I think it is a natural human tendency to look back at major events and sort of mourn the loss of the self that existed before that event.
Absolutely.
And I think that's, I think that's us. It's a, an act of love, you know, to say like, it's the same thing as like, if a loved one dies, would you not have trouble choosing like, well, could I choose to not have them be gone and be able to sit with them and talk with them? Or would I choose for them to be gone still? Because that's kind of what you're talking about here. You're, you know, the Haley that existed before is still here, but not in the same way, you know?
That is so true. Yeah. You know, a therapist that I was seeing said, like, you know, I think it's helpful to think about this as grief. Like, yes. and that, like, this grief is going to be, like, maybe, like, a lifelong journey. And mm-hmm. not that it's going to always, like, feel the same, and that, like, it will evolve as things evolve. Like, you know, my kids and I are in a better place now.
Yeah.
Like, we, like, I've had, are on, like, a medication journey with River that has been extremely helpful. And, you know, and I have Chris now, and we're getting yes. married soon. So, you know, yes, I'm like, I have more help. And he's, like, so wonderful with the kids. And,
he is.
You know,
that's
with
one of my
me,
favorite things.
He's just such a dream in every way. Love you, Chris Hillman.
I love you, Chris Hillman.
We love you, Chris Hillman. You're the best. yeah. No, no.
Yeah.
Only sounds of like just, yeah, absolute delight and joy about Chris Hillman.
Yep. That's how
just,
I feel.
Yeah. I was saying to him recently that like, you know, most things in life are like complicated in some way, but like with Chris and me.
Yeah.
It's not, it's like, it's just pure like happiness,
isn't
joy, light, connection. Like, and you know, the hard times will come, they always do, but they haven't yet. And you know, I think that he's just so fucking agreeable, kind, flexible, yeah. understanding. Like, how could you even have a fight with him? How could you even do it?
Oh, give me a chance. No, no,
I'll
no.
do it. I'll do it.
I don't think, yeah, I don't think I've ever had a fight with Chris.
I don't think you can because he's so reasonable.
What a jerk.
I know, that fucking guy. Yeah. No, yeah, he, it's really since the very beginning, it's been just a dream.
Yeah, for us too, like on our side of things. Really, it's wonderful to see someone you love fall in love. And especially when they fall in love with the person that you love, you know? So that's been wonderful from my standpoint. I can't speak for everyone else, but I feel like I can speak for everyone else.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I'm sure you've heard the tale of the way that it all went down.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, you were there. Well,
And
I played a little crowd control in the background.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know this part of the story.
Well, you know. I mean, I think you should, you know, what was your side of it? You know, or your experience of it?
All right, yeah. And then let's hear about the crowd control.
It's not that it's not that huge, but it's
it happened.
A little part.
It happened.
I like to feel like I had my hand in there.
Well, yeah, okay. So the back story is that, you know.
Thank you for joining us for part one of my conversation with Haley Hillman. As you can tell, Haley is about to regale us with the story of meeting Chris, but it actually starts with a change within herself, some decisions that Haley made, really, really tough decisions, things that would end up changing her life and sort of change her direction. It was really a fascinating conversation and inspiring as well. This second part of our conversation, we cover so many important topics. I was really thrilled by it. We not only cover a beautiful love story, but we also get to discuss some issues in our culture that have to do with our needs as accommodations in our society, the things that we do for each other in order to make each other feel safe. Haley is an incredible advocate for the needs of her family and her friends and herself as well. It's truly inspiring. I really appreciate how strong Haley can be and how her strength very often leads to empowering others as well. So hop on over to the next episode. It's already waiting for you. And as an added bonus, I asked Haley if there was any music that she would like to have featured on her episode, and she shot right back at me with a request to play Ricky Kendall's The Thrush from his album Soul Searching, which, by the way, you can find on Bandcamp, SoundCloud, Spotify. It's a wonderful album. If you're unfamiliar with Ricky, do yourself a favor and find a way to see him perform live. Find his albums. He's an incredible artist, heart-driven music, backed up with incredible talent. And it is no coincidence that somebody with as passionate and beautiful a soul as Haley would want a song like The Thrush featured on her episode. It pairs very well with it. So tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to open part two of our conversation with Ricky Kendall's The Thrush. And who knows? Maybe I'll close with it too. You'll just have to listen to find out. Thanks so much for finding your way here, and I'll see you next time.
What does it mean to love without the eight-all string?